I read your book, by the way.
Wow. That's a big enterprise. That's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, it's extremely interesting. It's you're focusing on Fauci. It's a pretty much complete history of what he has been doing, how successful he has been, both with respect to his endeavors and, of course, financially. I think I read that he's the one public official who makes the most money. He gets like $447,000 a year. It's more than the president. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, it's interesting because his salary technically should be about 70% less than that. But in 2002, after the anthrax attacks, the Pentagon began funneling huge amounts of money to Anthony Fauci. The Pentagon wanted to do bioweapons development, but they're blocked by the 1972 bioweapons treaty. But the treaty has a loophole in it that says you can do dual-use research, meaning if you can make the claim, the plausible claim, that what you're actually doing is developing vaccines or other countermeasures, you can legally do bioweapons research. And the Pentagon did not think it could get away with doing that on its own. So it began funneling money to Tony Fauci. And beginning in 2002, he really became an asset of the bioweapons industry and of the Pentagon. He took on a military function. And at that time, they gave him a 68% raise that came from his military involvement and is attached to his military involvement. And that's one of the reasons he was kind of forced to continue to do gain of function studies, even when everybody was criticizing them and Obama was trying to stop him. He continued to do it because he gets $1.6 billion a year for those kind of studies, for essentially military research, bioweapons research. And his salary comes from that as well. So 70% of his salary raise is attached to that work.
There was a halt in the gain of function experiments when I think Obama did it. Why is it that he continued doing this? Or is it not true that he continued doing this?
No, he continued doing it. So he began doing these studies around 2000. He did a study, 2001, after the anthrax attacks. He did a study by a researcher called Kuo, K-U-O, and that was the first one. And this actually is a study that should be loved by mice because they took a mouse coronavirus and they taught it to infect only cats. And that was the first time that they had successfully done that. And people were, even at that time, were outraged that they were toying with these kind of alchemies. And then a couple of years later, they funded a study that took the Spanish flu that has been extinct since 1918, and which was killing 1% of the people who were infected, and they resurrected it. In other words, they built a Spanish flu, a virus which did not exist on the planet at that time, and then there was a giant backlash, and you started getting a group of people, Richard Ebright from Rutgers and Mark Lipsitch, who are both bioweapons experts from Harvard. And they started leading a group saying the critics of Tony Fauci saying what he's doing is insane. And it is, if one of these things escapes, you will not be able to predict the trajectory. And then in 2014, there were three mishaps where, you know, 85 CDC workers were exposed, I think, to smallpox. They found, or anthrax. They found a, they uncovered a, somebody found an unlocked refrigerator in a basement of, at Fort Detrick, a batch of smallpox vials. And then there was another escape. So you had three escapes that were all publicized in a short period of time. And at that point, there was Tony Fauci. There was actually there was a panel that was supposed that they created after they recreated the flu, the Spanish flu. There was a panel that was created that had a Pentagon representative and then representatives of each of the agencies within NIH. And that was supposed to review all of gain of function for risk benefit analyses. Tony Fauci controlled the panel and he chaired it. He simply refused to convene it. He had also picked all the people who were running it except for the Pentagon people so he could dominate it. But when these three viruses escaped, he had a mutiny on that panel, and they insisted on being convened, and there was, and he ended up firing them. He fired half the panel. It was called the Saturday Night Massacre. And at that point, the people who had been fired from the panel were convened by Mark Lipsitch at Harvard and Richard Ebright at Rutgers, and they put together 300 leading scientists in the area, and they wrote a letter to President Obama saying, you got to stop Tony Fauci. And President Obama passed the gain-of-function moratorium. But while he was passing it, Fauci and Collins were fighting him, and they ended up winning a battle where the entire review process would be taken away from that other panel and put completely inside of NIH. And there was also a loophole that they installed that said, if they could show, if they could demonstrate to themselves, not to anybody else, that this was important for national security, they could continue the studies that Obama had banned. I think there were 18 studies banned, and they immediately restarted at least 9 of them, maybe 11 of them. It's all secret, so we don't know exactly what they were doing. And then Tony Fauci began shifting his resources to Wuhan to do these studies where they'd be out of sight of the White House, and they were laundering the money through this sociopathic, you know, British born zoologist, Peter Daszak. And at the same time, the CIA was pumping money into Daszak. So the CIA and the Pentagon were also laundering money through Daszak. So we ended up sending about $100 million through him from the Pentagon, from CIA via USAID, and from Tony Fauci. And Tony Fauci, although his studies were very important, he was only the third largest study, but he was coordinating with the intelligence agencies and with the military, you know, in everything that they did. And they, you know, the weird thing is they somehow convinced themselves that it would be okay. The Wuhan lab is run by the Chinese military. And the Chinese military is very open at what they're doing is bioweapons research. They don't make any, you know, they're not pretending it's something else. In fact, they published a study in 2013 in China in the Chinese language that explained exactly what they were doing and said, this is a very exciting area. And we can now, thanks to Tony Fauci, we now know not only how to make these viruses infect human beings, but also to hide the tampering. Tony Fauci, this is a, you know, one of the holes in Tony Fauci's story is he kept saying, well, this is about vaccine development. He was funding Ralph Baric in North Carolina to figure out ways to hide the tampering. They called it, Ralph Baric called it the no-see-em method, meaning you could create these viruses and then through the, what they call a seamless ligation process, you could hide the evidence of tampering. Oh, he funded Ralph Baric to develop that. Ralph Baric taught Ying Zhixi, the Bat Lady, how to do it. She succeeded in doing it on her own. And they had all these Chinese scientists. The Chinese in 2013 published a study that says, okay, now we this is a very exciting new weapons development area. And we can combine this with other technologies like freeze-dried technologies and to create delivery systems for the bioweapons we're making. This is all laid out in their report. I think they had 27 authors on this study about how to weaponize coronaviruses and flu viruses by doing these gain-of-function studies. And they talk about how to, you know, when they do get them, they can freeze dry them, that they have to be, you have to deliver them at night. You have to drop them over cities at night because the sunlight damages them. You need to take into account wind patterns. And it's all, you know, the Chinese were very open. What we are doing here is weapons development.
Why? I mean, after the all of the emails were brought out into the open, it was very obvious for anyone who can read that he was involved in gain of function experiments. Why does he still deny that he's doing that? Is he so sure of himself? Is he sure that he's still going to get the protection that he's had? Is he so sure that he's not going to get thrown under the bus? Or what's behind this?
Well, as I show in the book, he's made a career of lying and getting away with it. And even, you know, during the pandemic, he told a whole bunch of what he considers to be noble lies about masks, about the rates needed to a vaccination needed to achieve herd immunity, many, many other things. And he admitted publicly, oh, yeah, I lied about that. I lied to manipulate the public into doing the right thing. So he has in his brain this thought that he, because of that, he is the only one who possesses the genius to save humanity from these contagions, that he has a right, even a duty, to lie and, you know, to the public for its own good. So I think that he has a disconnect in his brain where he does not see that most people do not want to be manipulated. More importantly, he's gotten away with it and consistently gotten away with it. The New York Times reported his lies, reported that they were lies, and then gave him a ringing endorsement to do it. So I think he feels like, you know, it's like that he is not going to get, nobody's going to call him on it. And so far, he's been correct about that.
What about his, nobody really, at least outside of the United States, nobody really knew who Fauci was. He became a prominent figure with the start of the corona pandemic, as I would call it now. I'm not denying that there's a virus. We know that it can be really dangerous and it can be deadly for some people. But a lot of people, including our friend Judy Michalowicz, of course, is saying this is a pandemic. How was it that he has been making a career for so many years? I think it all started, if I remember correctly, in 1968 or so. How is it that he was invisible for most of the world, I think even for most Americans, until finally we came to the corona pandemic or plandemic?
Well, you know, I people who were part of the healthcare space, everybody knows who Tony Fauci is. He's, you know, he runs NIH, and he's been the primary author of agency capture within the agency. He's taken the agency, as I show in the book, away from doing public health and turned it into an incubator for pharmaceutical products. So what his agency, his mini agency, NIAID, does with its, you know, with his 7.6 or $7.7 billion annual budget, he gives away 13 times what Bill Gates gives away every year. So he's very, very powerful. Every virologist in the world knows him. The livelihood of virtually every virologist in the world relies in some way on Tony Fauci. Unless they have, you know, the weird, odd case where they may have an independent source of funding, but he can get to almost anybody. Between Fauci, Gates, and Jeremy Farrar of the Wellcome Trust, those three individuals control 61% of the biomedical research money on Earth. And what, you know, originally, and they also control, so they control what science gets done. They also control what science doesn't get done. In other words, people who want to research, for example, the connection between chemicals like glyphosate and certain diseases, or for example, the connection between vaccines and autism, we have the databases that could actually do those studies. You have to say, why have they never been done? When we sued HHS, they admitted that none of the vaccines, the 48 vaccines that are given to children during their first 6 months of life, none of them had ever been studied with a link for autism, not one, despite all the claims this has been disproven. So why did autism go under Tony Fauci's watch, why did it go from 1 in 10,000 people in my generation to 1 in every 22 boys in the United States today? These are CDC's numbers. Why did that happen? And it happened beginning in 1989. And that is the year the vaccine schedule exploded. We went from the three vaccines that I had as a kid to, beginning around 1989, to the 72 mandatory doses of 16 vaccines that my kids got. And so when Congress said to EPA, tell us what year the autism epidemic began, EPA scientists came back and said, 1989, it's a red year. Tony Fauci's job is to figure out what happened in 1989. We know that genes don't cause epidemic. They may provide the vulnerability, but you need an environmental toxin. So we need to identify what environmental toxin hit the population in 1989 that caused all these neurodevelopmental disorders, not just autism, but ADD, ADHD, OCD, speech delay, sleeping disorders, tics, Tourette syndrome, narcolepsy, ASD, autism, this whole constellation of neurodevelopmental disorders that began in 89. In addition, that year we saw an explosion in allergic injuries, food allergies. Suddenly, you know, peanut allergies appeared, and eczema, other allergic diseases, asthma, anaphylaxis, and then autoimmune diseases that year suddenly exploded. Rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile diabetes. If you're like me, if you were raised prior to 1989, you never knew anybody with any of these diseases. I never met a person with autism my age. I still haven't. Full-blown autism, you know, non-verbal, non-toilet train, head banging, stimming, toe walking. I've never seen anybody my age like that. Why? I had 11 brothers and sisters, 71st cousins. None of them had food allergies. Why do five of my children have allergies? You know, Tony Fauci's job is to answer that question for the past 50 years. Not only has he never done the studies, which would be simple, easy to do, but anybody who tries to do those studies, their career would be destroyed. So let's say there was a young scientist at Stanford University who's an associate professor, and he says, I have a great idea. Kaiser Permanente has a database, the HMO, the insurance group, has a database of 2.5 million patients. And it has the vaccine record of every one of those patients down to the batch number. And it has all their medical claims records for EpiPens, for albuterol inhalers, for Adderall, for anti-seizure medication, Prozac, or whatever. So all of that database is in one place. And now, and it's all mechanized. So you could just do a cluster analysis for each of these vaccine doses, and you can immediately crank out the answer in a couple of hours. So let's say a young professor says, hey, this is a great test. Nobody's ever done this study. I'm going to go do it. As soon as Tony Fauci will find out about that study immediately, because the guy's going to ask for funds, and he knows where he knows every application for funding. The dean of that medical school is now going to get a call from Cliff Lane or Hugh Auchincloss or one of Tony Fauci's hitmen who says to him, we hear that there's a clown in your school who's trying to do this kind of study. And, you know, we want to tell you that if he does that study, not only will it never get published because we control the journals, and number two, we're going to cut you off next year. Well, Tony Fauci gives to Stanford probably $500 million a year. He gave it, or Baylor University, $300 million a year. NYU, Harvard, all of the medical schools rely on Tony Fauci's largesse. And they're getting that money for drug development. And so Tony Fauci gives them these drugs to develop. And, you know, he develops. Here's what he does. This is a kind of simplification, but at NIH labs, he has petri dishes filled with cultures of various viruses. So he'll have hantavirus and Coxsackie virus and flu, coronavirus, et cetera. And he's got scientists there who are dripping drops of certain molecules, poisons, onto these viral cultures. And if the molecules kill that culture, and he says, okay, here, I got an antiviral that's effective against coronavirus. Now they have to give it to a rat and see if it kills the rat. So if it doesn't kill the rat, but it does kill the virus, then he says, okay, this could be a medicine. So then he farms it out to the university. The university may do a macaque study, a monkey study. And it recruits people for a phase one study. So they have 100 people. Tony Fauci gives $20,000 per recruit to the PI, the principal investigator. These are the key people who are the army, the commissars that do message discipline across the globe. When you look at CNN and you see these people like Paul Offit or Peter Hotez or Art Kaplan or Stanley Perlman who come on CNN every night, and they're presented as independent scientists. They're not. They're principal investigators, and virtually every one of them is taking money from Tony Fauci or Bill Gates or both of them. So these guys, the principal investigator is usually a powerful person in the medical school. He's the dean of a department or, you know, the chair of a department, and he's the one who gets the clinical trials. He runs the lab. He recruits 100 people for this, you know, Tony Fauci's drug experiment. And Tony Fauci may give him $20,000 per person. It's a lot of money. 50 to 75% of that money is skimmed off to the university. So now the university is on the hook to Tony Fauci. They become reliant on that fund. And he does the phase two, phase three. They're talking about maybe 30,000 people in a phase three trial, and they're giving huge amounts of money. So now he has to bring in the pharmaceutical company. They give half the patent to the pharmaceutical company. The PI keeps some of the patent, so he's now completely dependent on Tony Fauci. The university keeps some of the patent, and that is now their revenue stream. And Tony Fauci may keep some of the patent for himself. He may distribute patent rights to his favorite loyal deputies, and he may keep the patent for his agency. So Moderna, for example, the Moderna vaccine, Tony Fauci's agency owns half the patent and will collect billions of dollars in royalties. Tony Fauci is also given patent margin rights to between 4 and 6 of his favorite deputies. So they get to keep $150,000 a year for life. Oh, this is the system he's created. And not, his agency no longer does public health. The only thing it does is drug development. And you can see why. Now, this, I'll tell you how pervasive this is. Between 2009 and 2016, there were about 240 new drugs approved by FDA, all of them coming from Tony Fauci's shop. So, you know, he is the central incubator for drug development and pharmaceutical, and the pharma companies are his partners. He's not going to do regulatory actions against them. He's not going to find problems with these drugs. He is going to promote them. And that's how you advance in these agencies, by promoting these drugs.
Does he himself profit from this, or do we not know anything about this? Because there's so much money.
It's hard to get that data. We know that, and I don't believe that he does. I know he owns one patent, at least one patent on interleukin 2, mm-hmm. which he kind of, you know, let's say this, this is putting it uncharitably, but he kind of stole from Frank Rossetti and Judy Mikovits, you know, who were involved in developing that drug, but he got the patent. He got caught for it because there was a whistleblower in his agency who exposed that around 2004. And there was, you know, it was in the middle of a congressional investigation of Tony Fauci's experiments on little kids. He did these horrible, horrible experiments where he turned, you know, Black and Hispanic kids over to the pharmaceutical companies at foster homes so that they could test their chemotherapy HIV antivirals on these children. And a lot of children died. At least 85 kids died in those experiments. Many of them didn't even have HIV. And this was being investigated at that time. And during that investigation, it became clear that this drug called interleukin was, he owned the patent for it. So when the AP, a reporter called John Solomon did an article about it, and there was a furor at that time because no American and nobody in Congress knew that HHS was allowing its employees to make money on these patents. And to have walking rights or margin rights on patents of drugs they had worked on. And so Tony Fauci publicly said at that time that, don't worry, I'm going to give. At that time, they could own the patent. They were allowed to keep unlimited amounts of money from it. So Tony Fauci said, don't worry, I'm going to donate all the money from this patent, from the royalties, to charity. That was the end of the discussion. Nobody's ever been able to find what charity he's been donating it to. And, you know, there are charities and there are charities. There are, like, as Bill Gates knows, that there's something called philanthropic capitalism, which he, you know, boasts about. But, you know, if your charity is your kid's football team, or, you know, if their high school, their private school or whatever, or your charity is donating to a college to help your kid get into college, or, you know, there's a million things you can do that are charitable. Nobody's ever asked Tony Fauci, and he's never said what he does with that money. And I think it's probable that that is the only patent, because I think after that, because he was caught for it and the optics were really bad, I think after that, he started using first of all, HHS passed a new rule that said there was a maximum cap of $150,000 a year per patent. And since then, we know he's been giving patents on these drugs to favored employees, and it's basically a way to buy loyalty for him. And
It seems, however, that after the after his emails came out and after he was grilled in Congress by, I think, Rand Paul, the tide is turning, or am I mistaking this?
Well, I don't think between what's in my book and what, you know, the increasingly inquisitive Republicans in the United States Senate, I don't think that Tony Fauci is going to be there in 2 years. And he may go much faster than that, but it's not going to get rid of the system. You know, the system is in place. And, you know, getting rid of one guy will help. Because one of the things, the problems with having Tony Fauci in there is that everybody in the world is terrified of him. All of these people, I hear people all the time. And during my research of the book, again and again and again, people who are getting money from Tony Fauci, who are in the virology community, in the immunization community, you know, vaccine developers, et cetera, who say, we think he's corrupt, he's evil, but he's so vindictive and he's so powerful that I cannot publicly talk about him. And I think when he leaves, there is going to be a tsunami of revelations that come up from people who have hated him and been injured by him, but and have seen the, you know, the results of his conduct, but have been unwilling to speak up until now because of the you know, because of the power he wields. He and Gates and Farrar are, you know, they really are a very, very powerful trio, and they control, like I said, 61% of the biomedical research on Earth is controlled by those three guys, and they support each other. You know, Jeremy Farrar was stepped in to lead the cover-up of the Wuhan lab leak. He was the one who was, you know, putting together all of these scientists who signed the Nature article in March and the Lancet article in February, and he was involved from day one, and we now know that because we have the emails.
Mm-hmm. But do you think if Fauci was gone, do you think there would be like 100 little Faucis popping up doing the same thing?
Of course, you know, the whole institutional culture is corrupt. You can't survive at NIH if you criticize pharmaceutical companies. Oh, you know, Judy Mikovits and Frank Rossetti are just two of the names that you know of people whose careers have been destroyed by not just Fauci, but by NIH, by the institutional pharma-dominated culture at NIH. Bernice Eddy, probably one of the most important women scientists that our country has ever produced, one of the most awarded scientists in United States history. She discovered the poliomyelitis virus. She was, she played key roles in many of the great, you know, discoveries in NIH's history in the 50s and 60s. And she discovered that there was a monkey virus in the polio vaccines that was highly carcinogenic, a virus called simian virus 40, SV40. It was in 98 million polio vaccines that they were about to give to my generation. And she rang the alarm bells and said, you know, you're going to save a few people from polio, but you're going to kill 50 times that many people from cancer later on. And indeed, my generation has 10 times the soft tissue cancer as the previous generation that did not get that vaccine. Mm-hmm. And you can't say that we're getting it from the vaccine, but that virus is such a potent carcinogen that today it's used in laboratories all over the world to induce tumors in rodents. So, you know, you give it to a guinea pig and they just sprout tumors. And that was given because they shut up Bernice Eddy, they literally moved her into the basement. They changed the locks on her laboratories. They took away her telephone, you know, and they ran her out of NIH. The same thing happened with John Anthony Morris, who was for 40 years ran the flu program at NIH. And then he came forward and said the flu vaccines are a hoax. And not only that, they're causing neurological damage. And, you know, in 1976, when they had the first fake pandemic, and I'm not saying this pandemic is fake, but in my book, I talk about many pandemics that were fake. You know, the 2006, five avian flu pandemic, the 2009 pandemic, and I think I saw Wolfgang Wodarg on this call, and he he was the hero of that in exposing that pandemic, that fake pandemic to the world. And then the Zika pandemic was completely falsified, you know, by saying that Zika was causing microcephaly in babies. It was just a hoax. And he got Fauci, by faking that pandemic, got $2 billion from Congress to develop a vaccine, which, of course, you know, never materialized, of course, because it wasn't causing microcephaly. And on and on. And this is what they do there. And he was the first one, John Anthony Morris, was the first one to expose the fake pandemic in 76. And, you know, the head of CDC ended up having to resign because of that scandal. And that's when Fauci, that was his first fake pandemic, because he had come in 68. And by then he was second in command. He was running the lab. He was second in command at NIAID. And he was sitting in on the meetings when they met with Merck. And that was the first time that they gave immunity to vaccine companies, the first time ever. And it was his boss at that time that, you know, that made those concessions. So they were all having these secret meetings with Maurice Hilleman at Merck. And Fauci was part of that whole thing. So they've been doing that for years and years. And John Anthony Morris exposed it in 76, and he lost his job because of it. He was completely exonerated after a decade of lawsuits, but it ruined his life. So anybody at NIH who threatens the pharmaceutical paradigm is not just career destroyed, but they are eaten alive. They are marginalized, vilified, gaslighted, and just obliterated. They are made examples to the rest of the virology community of what happens to you if you challenge Tony Fauci or his pharma overlords.
Well, this is what happened to Judy Mikovits too. So what's going to happen to us, looking at what's going on in the United States from here, it looks as though this is going to be his last time around, his last turn, so to speak, because it looks as though even the mainstream, some, not all of them, of course, not the New York Times, but even some of the mainstream media are beginning to ask questions, probably, in my view at least, due to some of the footage that we've seen on the mainstream media of, for example, Rand Paul grilling him and seeing him in a he was almost frantic. He was losing it. He was yelling at Rand Paul. Is it that people are beginning to see who he really is? I mean, you describe him as, you are a lawyer, you describe him as a criminal, and I would agree with that after reading what you wrote about him. Is it that the public is finally coming to its senses as far as this man is concerned?
Well, he's been in one of my chapters in the book is about Teflon Tony, his capacity to have scandal after scandal, to continually fail upward throughout his career in terms of any public health metric. And yet, still have this, you know, adulation from the American media. And there's a bunch of ingredients that explain that. You know, in our country is one of only two countries in the world where pharmaceutical companies can do direct to consumer advertising of pharmaceutical drugs. And that has, so the pharmaceutical companies spend $9.6 billion a year on pharmaceutical advertising and promotion. And a lot of that ends up at CNN and, you know, Fox and ABC, NBC, CBS. They're dependent on those dollars. And, you know, and so they become really protectors of Anthony Fauci. And that's one of the things, that's one of the many, many dynamics, ingredients to that dynamic of why he is so bulletproof. You think about this. The United States had the worst outcomes, the highest body counts on earth during the pandemic. We have 4.2% of the world's population, and we had 14.5% of the deaths. We had more deaths than any other country. We, our death rates were like, I think, and I need to check this, but they're close, you know, they've vacillated, so I don't have the exact number now, but about 1,800 deaths per million population. You go to African countries like Tanzania, and it's double digits, maybe 50, 60 deaths per million. And we had one of the highest death count by almost any metric on earth. Why is Tony Fauci still in there? He did the inverse of what anybody would do if they wanted to stop a pandemic. He did not give us a medical response to a medical crisis. He gave us a militarized response and a monetized response. He did not, you know, they were not... Look, we know what to do, what you should have done. First of all, Tony Fauci should have appeared on TV and said what Franklin Roosevelt said to us, the only thing that we have to fear is fear itself. Mm-hmm. Do not be scared. We are going to handle this. And then he should have told us, we know that coronavirus is attack people who are low in vitamin D and low in vitamin and zinc. Everybody, here's the levels you should take. Here's what you should be doing. We know that it's going to attack people who are obese. So Americans, you need to lose weight. You need to get outside. You need to get sunshine. And you need to avoid foods with chemical residues. You need to avoid sugar drinks. And then instead of doing that, he went out and got the surfers who are in the sunshine in a place where coronavirus does not spread, ordered them off the beach into their houses. We know that this from the beginning, from what we were seeing in Italy and elsewhere, this is the virus that spreads indoors. It doesn't spread outdoors. So why did they lock the entire population indoors? In throughout human history, we have known that you quarantine the sick. And you don't quarantine the healthy. In China, they killed this pandemic by April. China had a 2-month pandemic and it was gone. How did they do it? Very aggressively identifying sick people and then quarantining them and treating them. By the beginning of April, China had published in Mandarin and other Chinese languages, medical protocols. Here's how you treat somebody who has a positive test for coronavirus. You give them chloroquine, which is, of course, the cousin to hydroxychloroquine. You give them antibiotics. You give them anti-inflammatories. You give them steroids. And then a whole bunch of Chinese herbs that contain quercetin, which facilitates the delivery of zinc to the cells, vitamin D, and all the things we know he should have been doing. Tony Fauci, to this day, has not published a protocol for treating early treatment. Instead, the people who come forward and say, hey, I got something that works here, you know, we're ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, those people are punished. They're silenced. They're vilified. They're censored. They're de-licensed if they're doctors. Their careers are destroyed for doing early treatment. The Chinese treated people and they found out what we find out. If you treat people early, 80% of them don't go to the hospital. What did Tony Fauci do? He told people, if you get a positive test, don't isolate, don't go to a quarantine facility and get treated. In fact, don't get treated at all. Go home to spread the disease to your family and don't take any treatment until you get so sick that you can't breathe. Then we bring you to the hospital and we give you two things that are going to kill you, remdesivir and intubation. Two things we know are going to kill you. Remdesivir was a drug that was developed by Gilead and Fauci and Gates. And in 2019, okay, December of 2019, it was, this is, you know, a month before he recommends it for coronavirus. It's the subject of a study of an Ebola clinical trial. So they're treating people with Ebola in Africa, six African countries. Ebola kills half the people who get it. And the safety monitoring board stepped in and pulled it from the study and said, this drug is too dangerous to give to Ebola victims. Okay? It's too dangerous to kill to one of them, to give to one of the most, the deadliest disease in the world. And yet we're giving it to coronavirus. And you know how it kills you? It kills you by shutting down your kidneys and shutting down your lungs, mm-hmm. the same way that COVID kills you. So those doctors in New York who were killing all those patients, they don't know whether it was the remdesivir that was killing them or the COVID. And what happens when you tell somebody to go home and sit there till they get sick? It's absolutely savage, barbaric medical response. When they do get sick and come back to the hospital, every one of those million people who went to the hospital was a super spreader event because they're infecting their families, they're infecting the ambulance driver, they're infecting the Uber driver, they're infecting everybody they see. So it was like exactly the inverse of everything we should have been doing, we did. And here's the other thing that he should have done. Instead of using his relationships with the social media to shut down knowledge about early treatment, he should have said to the social media companies, we need to create a grid, a communications grid to hook up to every one of the 11 million doctors in the world who are fighting coronavirus on the front lines. We need them to report what they're doing, to tell us what they think works, to talk about their experience, and develop a methodology for analytics, for measuring all the credibility of all those reports, and then fine-tuning a protocol day to day of finding all of the solutions that are working in Argentina and Tanzania and Kenya and Bangladesh and Switzerland and Italy and talking to all of these doctors who are, you know, who care about the patients, who are figuring out innovative ways to treat these patients and reducing deaths and reducing hospitalizations and giving them metrics to measure the effectiveness of their interventions and then reporting it all back and developing in a systematic way very quickly knowledge of the repurposed medications that seem to be working abroad and giving really honest data to all of the doctors who are on the front line in this country and the rest of the world. And that's the way you handle a modern pandemic. But that's not what they did. What they did is they were focusing on social control, on using the pandemic as an excuse for imposing totalitarian controls, telling people not to talk, shutting down any dissent about the government, of obliterating constitutional rights, religious rights, property rights, jury trials, all the things that due process, all the things they took away from us. Instead of practicing medicine, they use this event to, as a coup d'etat against constitutional governance, human rights, and democracy across the globe. I got to go. I got another podcast I got to go to.
That's all right. One piece of information that may be new for you, and of course we'll let you go. Today we spoke to a whistleblower who tells us that there were cases of COVID in the United States starting in July of 2019, and that there was a virtual ban, probably issued by Fauci, on all of these alternative methods of treatment. We're going to look deeper into this, of course.
I mean, I think, you know, from the data that I've seen, and I know there's contrary data, but and there's, you know, they have these tests where they're apparently finding it early in sewage treatment plants. But I think that they've, in my view right now, the best bet is that coronavirus escaped around September 12th. And there's a lot of indicia evidence of that, you know, the aerial photographs of the parking lots filling up, the chatter on the internet, the hospitalization of people from the Wuhan lab, the Chinese government, midnight that night, the Chinese government went into the Wuhan lab and removed 22,000 coronavirus samples. They scrubbed the internet of, you know, Tony Fauci and all of these gain of function studies. And there was a tremendous amount of suspicious activity that happened on September 12th. And then you had the World Games. Immediately after that, the military games. There was a lot of indicia that the Chinese government at that point was aware that it was spreading. They blocked certain roads. There was a lot of chatter. There was a lot of hospital activity. So my guess at this point is that it probably happened in September 12th. But of course, you know, nobody knows.
What if it really started in the U.S. and then through the military games, it was more or less exported to China? We'll have to look deeper into this.
That is exactly the kind of speculation I don't engage in.
Yeah, well, this is what we heard from a whistleblower. We're going to have to take a deeper look into this. Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time. We're all going to read that book. All of the viewers will read that book because it's written like a crime story. And that's what it is, really.
Thank you. Thank you, Reiner.
Thank you very much. See you later. Have a great day.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.